Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for being here. I'm Crosby Kemper. I'm the director of the Kansas City Public Library. Now I want to introduce somebody who has worked all of her life for civic concerns on both sides of the state line, despite her title as the mayor of Leawood, Kansas. She's also one of my heroes because she has done so much in this community for so many different organizations, and I think she spends her day every day helping other people, and she's a model for all of us. And she's very involved with American Public Square, whom we are very honored to have as to be able to present here at the library, and I'm very honored to present Mayor Peggy Dunn.
Thank you, Crosby. Very, very nice introduction. And good evening, everyone, and welcome. I am Peggy Dunn, and I am sorry that our fearless leader, Ambassador Alan Katz, was called out of town this evening. He's the one that should take the credit for putting together this esteemed panel that we're going to have the pleasure of listening to tonight on this very important topic, sense and sensibility. This is, you may know, the final program in a series of four that have been presented in partnership between the American Public Square and the Kansas City Public Library, and we are thrilled to have the Kansas City Public Library as our partner. It's a pleasure to welcome our panelists tonight. We have Bill Hall. I'll introduce the moderator in a few minutes. Bill Hall, Dr. Kenneth Thomas, and Michael Farron. And I want to thank you all for joining us tonight, and I know you'll have a more official, lengthy introduction shortly. I would also like to thank the Charles Koch Institute. They are the sponsors for tonight's event, and I don't know if Elliot Fox is here. Elliot, if you're here, okay, would you please stand and let us thank you and Koch Institute for sponsoring this evening. Thank you. I'd also like to thank American Public Square's season underwriters, the Hall Family Foundation, the City of Kansas City, Missouri, the Block School Endowment Board, and UMKC. I want to introduce a few people who are going to be assisting this evening. Steven Steigman will be our roving reporter. He is Chief of Broadcast Operations and Senior Producer of Up to Date for KCUR 89.3, Kansas City's public radio station. He, along with our volunteers, is going to be picking up fact checks and questions for our panel. And I want to introduce our UMKC librarians and fact checkers, Danny Wellemeyer and Jess Williams. Ladies, thank you for joining us. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Dr. Scott Helm. Scott Helm is a faculty member at the Henry W. Block School of Management at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where he teaches in the Master of Public Administration program and is the Executive Director of the Executive MPA program. Scott has an interdisciplinary PhD in Public Administration and Economics from UMKC. He's also an associate director of the Midwest Center for Nonprofit Leadership at UMKC. His primary research focus is social entrepreneurship. So please join me in welcoming Scott.
I'm going to read from here. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm going to briefly take my seat over here, but I just have a couple of things, and I welcome everyone tonight. I have a couple of ground rules for the American Public Square. Those members have heard these and could probably recite them from memory at this point, but I'll go ahead for the uninitiated. First, there will be no clapping. Oftentimes, clapping in these types of events or venues only serves to disrupt the flow of the conversation, And we're not going to be polling whether you agree or disagree with any of the sides, so there's no need to show your exuberance for a given point made by one of our panelists. It'll be a little awkward at first, but you'll be surprised how much faster the pace of the evening goes. We also have something we call the civility bell. If the tone or language of the conversation becomes less than civil, Wim Van Klinken, one of the advisory board members, and Mayor Dunn, and/or Mayor Dunn, also advisory board member, are bell ringers, and they will ring the bell like that. Stuffed into your playbill, you will also find question and fact check sheets that the mayor already talked to you a little bit about. Write down your, Jeff is holding them up here in the front table. Write down, if you have a question that you would like the panelists to answer, write it down. It'll be picked up by one of our volunteers, and Stephen, who will be roaming constantly throughout the evening, will get to it and read it out loud and allow our panelists to answer it. If you have a question about a factual statement that people make, that one of our panelists make, factual. If it's an opinion statement, that you can both have different opinions, but if it's a factual statement, write it down on your fact check sheet. Hold it up, a volunteer will pick it up, our fact checkers will look into it, and if they can find a conclusive answer, then they will be brought to our attention. We'll bring it to your attention. Now I'm going to introduce tonight's panelists. Immediately on my left is Mr. Bill Hall. Bill has been the president of the Hall Family Foundation, a private philanthropic organization dedicated to enriching the Kansas City community since 1982. He's also assistant to the chairman and the corporate officer at Hallmark Cards, Inc., which he joined in 1968. He holds a master's degree in finance from Southern Methodist University. Bill serves on the boards of many organizations, including the National Museum of Toys and Miniatures, the Marion and Henry Block Family Foundation, and the University of Kansas Hall Center for the Humanities. On Bill's left is Dr. Kenneth Thomas. Kenneth is a professor of political science at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. He received his PhD from the University of Chicago. He has been researching subsidies to attract investment for 20 years and has written two books on the subject as well as numerous articles. One of those articles we'll talk about in short order. His other research areas are multinational corporations, tax havens, and tax competitions. He blogs at Middle Class Political Economist. And finally, on the far, far left is Michael Farron. Michael is a research fellow in the Project for the Study of American Capitalism at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He's a PhD candidate in applied economics at Ohio State University and a licensed professional engineer. Michael's research focuses on the effects of government-granted privilege, specializing in labor, economic development, and transportation issues. He has been published in the Los Angeles Times, the Detroit News, and the Dallas Morning News. I'll make one exception for applause now. Please help me welcome our panelists. Great. So, Bill, if I could start with you. Not just out of convenience of location, but I think it makes sense to kind of begin to articulate your perspective on how incentive programs can benefit a community. So like PEAK or MoWorks, programs like that, why they could have a possibly positive impact on the communities.
Well, there's no question that there's a competition between states in terms of incentives. And it's sometimes is very difficult to compete if you're competing with another company or another entity that has received subsidies. Mm-hmm. In our particular situation, we have an unusual situation here where we don't believe PEAK, which is promoting employment across Kansas, or Missouri Works is appropriate in the Kansas City region. Mm-hmm. Kansas City has an unusual situation that few other cities have, and that is the state line running right down the middle. And what we're finding ourselves doing is providing incentives to move existing jobs back and forth across the state line. In effect, you can receive substantial subsidies by moving from the Missouri side of state line to the Kansas or vice versa, and you can have a significant ribbon cutting where the political figures, even if two equal companies moved, would celebrate that move. Mm-hmm. But the cost of that is very high to the taxpayer.
Sure. Is there ever a scenario where incentive programs that obviously businesses find advantageous can be beneficial to a community from your perspective?
Yes, I think there are instances. I think in terms of blight, in terms of retraining, mm-hmm. that there are times when incentives are appropriate in order to encourage development. The situation we've been involved in, we think, is wasteful.
Sure.
But there are times, in my judgment, where it can be helpful. Our efforts have not or do not oppose incentives, per mm-hmm. se. They oppose certain incentives that we believe are wasteful.
Great. So it's the outcome of the waste that results from the certain incentive programs in our particular situation in Kansas City is where the opposition primarily you're speaking to.
Right. That's the opposition that I'm speaking to.
Great. Kenneth, TIF is something you've studied in Missouri.
Right.
So could you kind of lay out for us what has been the impact of TIF, of tax increment financing policies in the state of Missouri?
Well, the overall impact of tax increment financing is, I think, again, rather wasteful. I was involved in a study with one of our PhD graduates, Susan Mason of Boise State University, and we did the first statistical study of what were the causes of why cities adopted TIF. And one of the biggest findings out of this study was that being adjacent to a city that used TIF more than increased more than 2.5 times the likelihood that your city would use TIF. And it tripled the likelihood that you would have a retail TIF. So the fact is there's just highly competitive dynamics. And if we look at TIF in the St. Louis region, you know, we can, in fact, I just saw there was a column by David Nicholas in the Post-Dispatch today or last night or something, that over the period from 1990 to the present, the different municipalities within St. Louis metropolitan region have put over $2 billion in TIF, also transportation development districts and some of the other related subsidies, for retail. And if you look at the actual number of jobs that's been created in that time, it's zero. The retail sector employs no more today than it did in 1990. And even in 2007, before the recession hit, the amount of increased employment was only 5,400, which if you were to attribute that all to the TIFs, which I don't think you should, given income growth within the St. Louis metropolitan area, that would still be a cost of $380,000 per job, and we're talking about retail jobs, which aren't the highest quality.
Fairly stark story that you're telling right there as far as St. Louis goes. Now, Michael, I don't think you're going to disagree with your two colleagues up here on what they said thus far. But so you're researching government granted privilege. If you could kind of lay out, kind of stake your position on where, you know, why government granted privilege is not necessarily advantageous to a capitalist system.
So essentially, government-granted privilege, it changes incentives of the players to actually chase the privileges rather than chase mutually advantageous business deals, which is what generally happens in a capitalist system, one that revolves around free enterprise. So one of the key things that goes wrong is you have people that are highly innovative, highly entrepreneurial, and rather than trying to develop those skills and use them to the best benefits of other people, which is how you create value and how you profit in a capitalist system. Instead, you're going to be chasing the ways that you can use the levers of authority, of governmental authority, in order to create that same kind of profit, that same value. And so you're taking the best minds and you're applying them to the worst causes.
So, and just for those who are uninitiated, maybe with the academic jargon or some of these things, when you say government-granted privilege, you mean?
So a lot of people understand governmentally granted privilege as cronyism. Our research program specifically avoids that because cronyism implies that there's a kind of an old boy kind of dynamic of a long-term relationship between the person that is being privileged by the person in government. But that's not necessarily the case. It's just a matter of chasing the fact that you're going to be treated specially by government for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my question to all three of you really is, Given what you've already laid out as both from a factual basis and what you've observed also with these government incentive programs, why are we doing them? Is it strictly a political calculation? Why are we doing these things, Bill, if they're hurting our communities?
Well, I think on the global scale, which is, I think, what my other panelists are much more knowledgeable about than I am, but it's meeting competition. And it's a situation where, as you said, if one city starts, the next one does it. So people feel they have to do it in order to meet competition. In the situation that I'm involved in, which is a much narrower focus,
absolutely,
then I think that there are a lot of reasons, but there is certainly the desire by politicians to cut ribbons and have events. In our case, there's a tremendous distrust at the state level between Missouri and Kansas. Mm-hmm. There's also some distrust at the local level. But I think, for the most part, it is this inability to get people to understand or discuss the issues in a constructive way. And if we could get that done, I think we could solve some of the problems.
Well, distrust, Bill just mentioned distrust. I'm going to come back to you, Michael, for a second, because I think what some people might say is, okay, if we could start over and in an ideal world, you're a smart guy, I'm willing to go along with it, but we're not starting at ground zero here. We're starting at a system where people have already received TIFs and there's this kind of spillover effect between other communities. I don't trust that if I'm in Kansas City, Missouri, and we don't do it, that Kansas City, Wyandotte County won't do it. How do you reply to them? Because we're not at this kind of conceptual level. We're already in the trenches and these programs are already taking root.
So the question is how do you get away from the situation we're in right now?
Yeah, how do you enter into a system where this is already part of the incentive structure? How do you get away from that when it's already kind of a trained behavior between government and some of the community?
Well, that's exactly what the research program that I'm a part of is trying to figure out.
Yeah.
that's literally our full-time job, how to create institutions, rules of order and governance that lead away from this perversive cycle of malfeasance. Mm-hmm. That might not be exactly the right word, but it's not a virtuous cycle. It's a very vicious cycle of how do we get out of it. I don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. I think if anyone actually knew, they would be trying to put those ideas into play. A lot of economic development officials will come right out and tell you that this is not good. Like, we have to compete because everybody else is competing. I think it's going to take some, at the very least, at the very beginning, some principled people standing up and saying, no, we're not going to do this. And maybe we're not going to get the big, flashy jobs and ribbon-cutting ceremonies as a result. But it needs leadership. Mm-hmm. And it needs someone sticking their neck out and taking that risk politically, because it's a political risk. That's the first step. Past that, some interstate compacts might be the way to go. But the question is how do you get agreement on those? Because Kansas and Missouri can't even start to agree on this yet.
And what's the enforcement mechanism if someone breaks that agreement, right? I mean, that comes into play also.
Absolutely. That you have to design an incentive-compatible system. Mm-hmm. And that's where the cutting edge research is in this area. I wish I could tell you that there was an answer. I could speculate a lot, but that wouldn't be terribly helpful.
We got time to speculate in a little while. So, Kenneth, when we talked earlier before this evening, you said there is conceivably an environment in which incentive programs could work. Or you've studied internationally different type of programs that potentially are successful for economic development. Maybe they're not strictly business incentives. Could you give us a picture of something that could work in this area?
Well, I tend to think that the garden variety investment attraction subsidies aren't particularly useful. They always have spillover effects. You know, the most egregious spillover effects are the kind here in the Kansas City area, where all you're doing is moving jobs from one place to another that already exist, and yet taking $20 million out of one jurisdiction's tax coffers, and then later the other jurisdiction does it. And that's just, you know, a complete negative sum game. There's no new jobs created, and each government winds up giving away a little more each round. And so there's that, and that's the worst kind. But even when it's a new facility that you're talking about, you are creating problems for existing competitors. You know, usually, like if you build an auto plant, it's not, you know, you're going to be building 200,000 or more cars a year, and yet the demand for in the country hasn't increased that much, but supply of auto plants is lumpy. So it's going to negatively affect some of the other ones. They'll go from three shifts to two shifts or what have you. Eventually, one will close down. In the 1980s and early 90s, when we were seeing so many new plants built in the U.S. and Canada, for every one that opened, another one closed. Mm-hmm. This is assembly plants, you know, at the final assembly level. So, but what can work, and this isn't so much by research, but for example, Timothy Bardick at the Upjohn Institute, he's interested in incentives that don't have much of these negative spillover effects. And so things like training, you know, training at individual firms and training of individual workers, you know, means that, you know, this person has more skills anyway as a result, and so that creates new value down the line. And also kind of similar what he calls industrial extension, analogous to agricultural extension, where I would expect mostly smaller firms get consultations on how best to improve their efficiency and that sort of thing. And those are the sorts of things that can work, but, you know, we need to move away, and I'll have a lot more to say about what else we can do later.
Okay, yeah. Okay, great. Bill, I'll come back to you for a second. I know you're the head of a foundation, which a nonprofit foundation, but also as your bio talked about being of, you know, with Hallmark for a very long time. What's the role of businesses on this topic? I mean, the simple answer to the thing to say is if businesses stopped trying to access these incentive programs, they wouldn't exist. That's easy to say sitting up here, but when you're trying to maximize profits or improve bottom lines, you're going to take advantage of the opportunities that potentially present themselves. So what are businesses' role in kind of perpetuating this system?
Well, a lot of people have asked us that because obviously we have taken advantage of incentives in the past, and we recognize there is nobody out there that I know of in these two programs that's done anything that isn't absolutely legal, that is in any way negative. But the problem is getting enough business people who understand the larger picture of why this is detrimental to the community that they should stand up, and I'm not saying not take the incentives when they're there, but get the public policy changed so that they're not competing with someone who is taking advantage. You know, if you're a law firm on the Kansas City, Missouri side and you move over to Kansas, you can lower your rates by the amount of the rebate that you're going to get for taking your employees' state withholding tax. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're the law firm in Missouri that stays in Missouri, you know, you're going to be at a competitive disadvantage.
Sure.
So there has to be a change at the public policy level. It can't be expecting the businesses to disadvantage themselves against each other.
Mm-hmm. So how does that process begin? I mean, is it simply advocacy from groups like, I don't know, like chamber groups, or is it advocacy from businesses working with the elected officials?
I think it's both. I think you have to have the organizations that represent business, and you have to have individual businesses themselves. We started out with 17 CEOs sending a letter to both governors asking them to get into this matter and to resolve it. That was 5 years ago, and we're still working at it, and we're going to continue to work at it until we get this resolved. But I think it has to start with the leadership of businesses that are on both sides of the state line. We have large facilities on the Missouri side, we have large facilities on the Kansas side. And we need to convince the elected officials that it's in this community's best interest to not waste that money, but to use it more wisely.
Okay. So waste has come up a couple of times, and I'll go back to you for a second, Michael. And when we say waste, let's make it a little more tangible. What does that really mean for the people who are sitting in the room tonight, when waste that comes from these type of programs? What does that mean?
So perhaps a good example to follow up with kind of what Bill was saying, and the fact that you need some leadership of business leaders, and I think you also need leadership of government officials. Maybe to say simply that some people need to step forward and say, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. In terms of, so then to segue into your question, Tesla, when they put in their Gigafactory outside of Reno, Nevada, they went through this really elaborate process where they brought in economic development officials from half a dozen different Western states and flew them into a room, and they didn't know why they were coming in. They just said, you have to come, and it's in your best interest to be here. And they said, we're looking at building this massive multi-billion dollar factory, and we want you to give us an economic development package within the next 2 months. And by the way, you all have to sign non-disclosure agreements, and you're not allowed to talk to each other and let each other know. And we're just going to play you off one another. So Tesla is going to expense to do this. And they're pursuing benefits and privileges from government officials. So economists call this rent seeking. It's an old term that essentially means you're expending profits or expending money that you could be using to lower your prices, streamline your production process, things like this, and instead you're using it to chase other means of creating value, which is twisting the gears of authority in your favor. And then the government officials then are also running around trying to craft their own incentive agreements. So it's causing waste both in the private sector and pursuing this, and it's causing waste in the public sector and trying to satisfy the private sector.
So when we talk about waste, what we're really talking about is the CEO of like Tesla in your example gets to increase their profit, their bottom line, while operating at a less efficient level.
Exactly.
Right. So they're not achieving any type of efficiencies. They don't have to. Mm-hmm. They're investing in other things. One of the big things in I know Kansas City is the hot topics is always tax increment financing and TIFs, and that's a very specific sort of incentive program. And Kenneth, I was hoping that maybe you could, because you've done some research on TIFs, just explain a little bit to the audience about what payments are made in lieu of taxes sometimes with those. Who are often, you heard Crosby talk about being the victim, one of the largest victims of TIF financing. Why is that taking place? Because I think there's a lot of confusion out there to people on who benefits and is hurt by these kind of programs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, perhaps odd view of TIF, which is basically it's just another subsidy, right? It has its own specific legal requirements, but when you get down to it, it works just like any other investment attraction subsidy for a particular locality. So with TIF, right, essentially you're mortgaging your future anticipated increased tax revenues. Often it's done directly via a bond. Sometimes it's pay as you go. I mean, I know Kansas City uses pay as you go a lot. But essentially, if you pledge all this tax revenue in the future to the developer, to the firm that's involved. And the problem in Missouri, it's not necessarily a problem in every state, but a lot of states do have this problem, is that the city or the municipality that does this can divert the tax revenue from all the taxing districts involved in the property tax. And
so taxing districts, what do you mean?
Like the library district, the school district, of course, are normally the largest loser because they're the biggest recipients of property taxes. And then in Missouri, we do even worse than that because a sales tax can be applied 50% of the future revenues towards reimbursing the developer their eligible costs. So Kansas City, of course, has had some gigantic ones. Now St. Louis City has had a couple as well with IKEA and the Northside Regeneration Project. So, but definitely, the fact that in Missouri, unlike, say, California, which changes only in the past few years, in Missouri, the city can just take away from the other cities their future tax revenues, and they don't have enough say in it to stop it.
Does the city still get money in this, like the from the TIF? There's this concept of payment in lieu of taxes, right?
Well, but that's what that means in Missouri is the owner of the property is deemed to have paid their taxes, mm-hmm. but then those get diverted right back to whoever got it.
Okay.
So for property taxes, 100%, sales taxes, 50%. So in Missouri, the city could wind up with 50% of the sales tax, increment in the future.
Okay. Stephen, I had you and I've lost you. Oh, there you are, Stephen. Hi.
Hi. Well, you won't be surprised to know that we have a lot of wonderful questions this
Great.
Evening. It's a popular topic. That's why you're all here, right? Oh, and by the way, that's podcast 699, Planet Money. You can find it at npr.org. My underwriting is over now. So a couple of great questions. You're talking about them right now, but just going a little bit deeper. How do you encourage redevelopment of blighted areas without incentives? Isn't it realistic to expect redevelopment to happen, or is it realistic to expect redevelopment to happen without TIF or transportation districts or community improvement districts? And along those lines, what are the effects or implications for those who have to pick up the slack to make up lost revenue, and how are our city's infrastructures suffering?
So, Michael, I'm going to start with you on that one. How do you, because it's a version of what I asked earlier, which is, are we going to get development in blighted areas? Can you speak to that question a little bit?
So there are some, I know of one or two good examples where some tax incentives, or in this case, it's actually different regulatory structures are in place that encourage redevelopment. Specifically, it's West Virginia, and it's going in and it's redeveloping old coal mines. Yeah. And so they're causing a problem of acid mine drainage, and the state essentially says, we're going to go ahead and we're going to tax some current coal production, and then we're going to put that towards giving you an incentive to redevelop these old mines to clean up a public problem. That is one situation. So essentially all you're doing at that point is you're taking public tax money, and it's not as much of a development incentive as it is as you're paying someone to clean up a problem. You could take that same tax money and put it toward a private contractor and just go clean it up, and then we're going to resell the land later on and earn a profit off of it. So that's a little bit different, I think, than actually a pure tax incentive of please move here and bring your jobs here.
So the tax in that case is going to remediate the land so
exactly.
it can be developed.
It's deemed to be a public good to remediate this land, to solve this problem that is having negative spillover effects on other people, as opposed to bring in something that may or may not actually cause beneficial spillover effects. Because that's one of the problems with these tax incentives and econ development is the actual benefits may or may not be what people say they are. It's pretty, the math and the science is very much out on that.
Okay. Bill, is there anything from like a business leader perspective that would incentivize a business person to, I shouldn't use incentivize in this discussion, that would encourage a business to invest in blighted areas without these kind of incentive programs?
I think it just depends on the competition. If you're competing against people that are incented, then you're going to have to be able to have the same kinds of incentives in order to compete. I do think there are instances, though, where there have been organic redevelopment of blighted areas. And I think in many respects, the crossroads in Kansas City, there have been different incentives that have come in there. But for the most part, in my view, that started out organically really with artists,
mm-hmm.
and they overcame the blight that was in the crossroads. But if someone else is getting an incentive and they can bring something in at a lower cost than you can, it is very difficult to get anybody to compete against someone who's incentivized.
Yeah. So it's almost like we have to go cold turkey.
Well, yeah, I mean, to me, when you ask the question about state compacts, to me it almost has to be a federal situation where there would be something like you are going to tax incentives. The federal, you know, if you get an incentive of $100 million, mm-hmm. it's a taxable event to you.
Okay.
And so I think it's either going to be solved on the federal level or it isn't going to be solved. You know, you have the prisoner's dilemma.
Absolutely,
here.
Yeah.
That's exactly what this is. And you, mm-hmm. you put the developer in one room and you put the government official in the other, and you know, what are they going to do? Is the developer going to go somewhere else? What if I don't give him the incentives? How does the public react to that? It's a very difficult situation.
And if you obviously want to get in on this.
Oh, yes. Well, certainly I agree that it's a prisoner's dilemma, but the prisoners are two different cities. You know, both with the opportunity to bid on a particular project. But let me start with the original question from out there, which is, what do you do about really blighted areas? And the answer is, most likely you do need some sort of incentive to deal with truly blighted areas. But the only way that that kind of a system can work is if areas that aren't blighted can't do it, right? I mean, if the pair can give a subsidy to bring in Nordstrom's, to West County Center in St. Louis County, how is Page Dale or Normandy or some small city supposed to compete, even if they can have incentives? If a rich area that's already attractive can use incentives, poor areas are just going to lose. And that's one of the problems that you find on all sorts of scales. I mean, you know, internationally, nationally, and locally. And so, you know, to me, you've got to be able to set up a system. And I think I agree completely with Bill that it ultimately has to be federal or it won't work at all. Although it's hard to imagine that politically, but that's the truth because it is a prisoner's dilemma. There's lots of research. How do you solve these kinds of cooperation problems? And a lot of it really requires third-party enforcement. We talked about enforcement before. And in this case, the third party would have to be the federal government, right? So, because there have been lots of voluntary interstate compacts. I mean, the one we're looking at now is actually the strongest we've ever seen, if it happens. But there have been voluntary compacts between Missouri and Kansas before, between New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut before, between the Council of Great Lakes governors before, all failed, usually even before the ink was dry, even before they came into effect. Somebody was raiding one of the other states. So that's why you need enforcement that has to be at the federal level. So let me just give you the example of what actually does work, although how we translate it into our political institutions is a big question. In the European Union, they have a system of what they call state aid control, right? State aid is just their term for subsidies. So, the way it works is first to have transparency, and I think transparency is the first thing we need to get from where we are to anywhere we might go in reform. We need to know what's actually happening. Like my estimates show that about $50 billion a year is spent on investment attraction. So if you want to talk about waste, that's the ballpark figure of what the overall effect is from the state and local level. So first you need transparency. The European Union achieves that by having requirement that all subsidies or subsidy programs have to be notified in advance, and they can't be implemented until the European Commission approves them. So this is hard to get our heads around, right? I mean, we're talking about 50 states here, and you know they're fighting amongst themselves all the time. But in the European Union now, we're talking about 28 independent countries that somehow managed to do this. I mean, enforcement's been, you know, a 30-year legal battle, but, you know, probably we shouldn't expect it to be any quicker here, but that's how it works. The second thing is, and this gets to the point I had started at, which is you've got to keep these incentives out of the hands of rich areas and focus them on poorer areas. So you can also focus them on specific kinds of issues like research and development or whatever. But I think, you know, when we want to talk about blight, which is a big issue here, you know, this kind of, what they do is that there's rules that set for every region of the European Union a maximum amount of subsidy that can be given to attract. So the richest areas can't give any, the poorest areas can give the most, which right now is about 40%. And lastly, and I'll stop with this point, the last thing the European Union does is that for really large projects, they cut even those maxima from the last point by half for a project that's bigger than 50 million euros and by 66% for any project that's over 100 million euros. So really large projects like Tesla or Boeing or what have, oh, I shouldn't leave, Boeing's complicated, but Tesla or Advanced Micro Devices in New York or so, I'm sorry, yeah, in New York, we're talking about multi-billion dollar projects. They can get multi-billion dollar incentives in the United States. There's no such thing as multi-billion dollar incentives like that in the European Union just to attract somebody from one location to another. There's hardly any $100 million incentives, whereas we've got dozens just since 2000.
Great. Stephen?
No surprise. I'm being inundated with questions, which is great.
Let's keep it going.
So if I don't get to your question, please. What's the panel's opinion on incentives given for development of apartments downtown? Is it good for KCMO taxpayers? Is it bad for KCMO taxpayers? And the same question for Cerner and Burns and McDonnell. And along those lines, I'm going to ask you a few questions. So I can get them in right now. Thoughts about residential versus business developments, and thoughts on the Hallmark property recently sold for residential development that was declared blighted. And the question came up, is there really blight, and what defines blight in Kansas City, Missouri?
Great. So I want to break that into two questions. The first is does it matter residential versus commercial? And I'll start with you on that one, Michael.
Does it matter residential versus commercial in terms of whether or not you offer incentives?
Yeah.
Or
and from your perspective, are incentives any better if it's a residential, has a residential use versus a commercial use?
So essentially the problem inherent with incentives is that they, or offering the incentives, is that they change the incentives. So prices exist in the economy as a signal of the valuation of a particular piece of property in this case. And if a commercial developer values it more, they're going to bid a higher price for it than a residential developer. And so there's a whole bunch of information floating around in individual people, homeowners, developers, things like that, that gets consolidated into one single signal, which is the price. And so we call it the knowledge problem in economics, that you are taking all of this information, you're boiling it down into one signal. If you offer different incentives, if you try to favor residential development over commercial development, things like that, then essentially what you're doing is you're distorting the signal. And by its nature, you're making the economy less efficient. By nature, you are making the economy grow less quickly because you're causing funds to be diverted away from where they ought to be going to and going somewhere else.
Okay. Blight. Kenneth, what does blight mean? I mean.
Well, under current Missouri law, blight means whatever a city says it is. Whatever a city says it is.
Okay.
If a city says it's blighted, as far as the state courts are concerned, it's blighted. And that's true in most states. I mean, some states it's stricter than others. But the right way to do that would be to have objective measures. And again, that's what they do in the European Union. In the European Union, whether you're eligible to give 10% of the value of an investment or 20% will depend on what is the GDP per capita and what is the unemployment rate. So two objective measures. There have been some bills proposed in Missouri that would incorporate those kinds of metrics into the state TIF law, but they never got anywhere. They were like 10, 15 years ago, primarily being proposed, yeah.
And so, technically, blight is a subjective concept in these incentive programs, at least in Missouri.
Right.
Interpreted by the city.
Right.
Did you want to weigh in on either one of those? I'm sure
probably
some people.
Not.
Yeah. I didn't want to throw the Hallmark one in your lap. But.
I'm not involved on that end of the
Absolutely.
Company, so this is kind of my opinion that's probably pretty much uninformed. But my feeling would be, who are we competing against? and did they receive incentives? And if we're competing against people in the Power and Light District, which I believe we are, we're seen as a part of downtown, if we're competing against other people who, in order to determine what their rents are, they're based on the availability of incentives, then we're in a position where, in order to compete, we have to have the same kind of financing structure to compete with people who've already received incentives.
Sure. So, and essentially that argument gets into this rules of the game, right? So if everybody should have to play by the same rules of the game. Is there any scenario, Michael, from your perspective, where any type of incentive, you gave the coal mining example, short of kind of remediating a property so it can then be competitively fought over, is there any other case where an incentive isn't cronyism?
So you can make the argument that, okay, maybe this thing, this idea, this incentive, this isn't really bad. We can let this one slide. But if you let that one slide, that sends a signal to all of the innovators and entrepreneurs out in the rest of the market. They're like, oh, they were able to get that one through. I wonder if we can get something else through. I wonder if it's a slippery slope problem. And then the next thing you know, you have Tesla squeezing $1.3 billion out of Nevada, which is has one of the smallest state budgets out of the entire 50 states, and they're currently building a road up over the mountains for literally no reason. And I can say this as being a transportation engineer. I looked into this. They're building a highway up over the mountains to satisfy the land developer because he gave them the property to Tesla for free, but he got the state to build him the road to go into the deeper part of his business park so he could access his business park. So it ends up with this elaborate distortion of uses of governmental authority. And so I think if you start taking one step down that road, one step is too many, you're eventually going to end up where we are now in a prisoner's dilemma.
Okay. Stephen.
I'm going to take a statement and turn it into a question. It's Jeopardy time. Does the city of Kansas City track TIF and tax abatements? Do they have any idea how much money has been committed to these giveaways? Or do they have a process to evaluate the success of these abatements? Anybody know?
Well, I happen to have some notes on some statistics here. How many were they in Kansas City, Missouri? There are 70 TIF plans. This is from the Kansas City Economic Development Corporation. 70 TIF plans, 23 downtown and riverfront, 9 Midtown and Plaza, Crossroads West Bottoms 8, Northland 13, East Kansas City 6, South Kansas City 9.
I guess the big question here is, how do we know it's working?
Well, I think
and what's
is
the evaluative process for this?
Kenneth?
Okay, first of all, the city does have to report to the state, and that last I saw, it goes to the state auditor's office on every single project that they do. Eventually, it looks like to me, because I've been looking at the state annual reports since like 2000, and they've gotten a lot better now because cities are prohibited from using TIF for 5 years if they don't file these reports. So the reporting's gotten better, and this is, like I say, one step towards further transparency. But the evaluation, I'm not sure what Kansas City does as far as its evaluation goes. Obviously, what's his name? The mayor that just left.
Oh, Mayor Funkhauser?
Right. Well, Mayor Funkhauser was auditor. Obviously, he was very interested in the issue of how evaluation happens and was very critical of how evaluation happened in Kansas City and, reported in several reports on how many projects failed to fulfill their job promises and that sort of thing. And so, whether it's here in Kansas City or elsewhere in the state, they have to make reports, but the evaluations are, very unevenly done and very often not acted upon when they're negative. And so, that's one thing that a lot of organizations try to track. There's one known as Good Jobs First in Washington that does a lot of reporting on transparency and on how well states actually monitor the subsidies they've given for compliance.
Isn't part of the issue, though, this kind of what Bill keeps coming back to, which is even if you evaluate one of these programs, the building's already built, the company's already received the benefits, and so all you can really do is stop at the next one from going in versus you're not going to roll back the one that already is in place.
Sure you can. You can roll it back. But you have to put it in the initial contract. Ypsilanti, Michigan found that out to its dismay when it tried to reclaim some subsidies from General Motors when it closed a bunch of its facilities back in the 90s. But in lots of parts of the United States, of course, lots of in the European Union, it's normal to do it.
Sure.
That you can write a clawback clause, as it's called, that lets the state government or city government reclaim the funds from the company. And that's actually been an important part of the European Union's enforcement tools against its member states that make illegally granted subsidies, is you require that money be paid back even if it bankrupts the company. So, yeah.
Seems like it might be a little less likely here in our climate, so to speak. Have you have examples in Missouri of rollbacks on these kind of?
Yeah, I mean, I know when Governor Nixon.
Aquila and H&R Block.
Aquila and H&R Block. There you go. Okay.
Okay. I mean, there definitely were some, and I know Governor. I remember reading some press releases from when Governor Nixon was Attorney General of different clawbacks they've made, and they've continued since then. Mm-hmm. So they exist in Missouri. Mm-hmm.
Bill, I think one of the things that is kind of incumbent upon this conversation is the idea of it was in Stephen's question of what is an effective outcome of a program, and I think part of what we have to look at is who when we talk about effective, who are we talking about it for? Because effective for the business or effective for the community? And since it's a government dollars, I think a lot of people are saying effective for the community. Because you said in certain blighted areas or in certain circumstances, what would you imagine an effective incentive program potentially could look like?
Well, I want to focus on PEAK and Missouri
Great.
Works.
Great.
And it's a very effective program for the person who gets the subsidy. And it's a very ineffective program for the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. If you have a situation where you move from one side of state line to the other side of state line, and let's say it's Missouri to Kansas. Missouri loses the revenue, and Kansas forgives the revenue. Mm-hmm. We have had roughly $500 million spent with no new existing jobs. Mm-hmm. Not one additional job was in that $500 million.
Yeah.
And the only person who's benefited from that, which they certainly had the right to do, was the company and the owners of the company who received that subsidy, that rebate. And there's a certain, one of the things that bothers me about this is kind of the moral aspect of it, that my neighbor is paying his employer, not his fault, but that's the way the public policy is left. My neighbor is paying his employer and I'm paying his taxes. Mm-hmm. And that's the way this program works. And this program, it isn't about blight, it isn't about retraining. It's about the absolute wasteful use of money for no public purpose.
Yeah, Michael.
I was just going to weigh in a little bit on that because I think that's a great segue into if you just expand this out instead of my neighbor across the state line to the entire U.S., it makes the problem that much more clear of all the money that is spent to move a firm from place A to place B, regardless if it's from one side of Kansas City to another, regardless if it's from Maine to California, if there aren't new jobs within the economy, if there's just simply taking one company, a flighty firm, and moving it to another place, that's wasted funds for the entire economy. That's lower growth over the long run for the entire nation.
Great. Stephen?
Well, along those same lines, does Kansas or Missouri have a specific advantage in the border war? And if not, would it not be mutually beneficial to disqualify greater Kansas City businesses from programs that simply incentivize a company to border hop?
And that's a lot what you're talking
about. No, the governors of each state are kind of working on this, but not really.
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Each state believes the other state has an advantage. And we have agreed that we want to find out whether or not that, in fact, is true. In Kansas, they've talked about leveling the playing field, and that usually relates to the length of a TIF in Missouri versus the possibility of a length of a TIF in Kansas. But there are other incentive programs in Kansas that are more favorable than those in Missouri. So it is hard to know, you know, who really has the advantage. The thing that we have tried to emphasize to both governors and to both legislatures is if you will take what is the, when I think about this in disarmament terms, if you'll take the intercontinental ballistic missile, which is Missouri Works and Peak, and you'll just agree to take both of those off the table, then everything else stays the same. We don't have to get into some of the other issues that are relatively minor. They really don't affect people's decision to move. What happened is in 2008, after the recession, people upped the amount of incentives with this rebate program for your state taxes. And that is inducing people to make the move. People aren't making moves based upon business decisions. They're being bought and sold. And so if we could take this large program, you get about somewhere between 27 and 30,000 an employee to move across the state line. If you could take that off the table, we would calm this down dramatically in Kansas City and all be better for it, because there is no more divisive issue to the community, and this community has to cooperate. There's no more divisive issue than having a firm leave one city and go to another, or leave one state and go to another.
Is there any anxiety out there that if that did take place, then corporations may move outside of both?
That's always been kind of a red herring that's been put out there.
Yeah.
We don't know of any situation where that has occurred, where there wasn't a business reason for the move. The NCAA.
Okay.
They were bought by Indianapolis.
Yeah.
We could not have competed with the amount of money that Indianapolis put up. There's a firm that was the mining firm, the drilling firm, that got those miners out of South Africa. They went to Houston because there are more drillers in Houston. But we don't know of any circumstance where a company moved out of Kansas City because they weren't given enough incentives.
I do want to take a second and see if have we had any fact checks, or to kind of check in with my fact check team. Jeff, Stephen is on his way to you. I'd say at a canter type pace, maybe a trot. Mm-hmm. Now it's a walk.
We did have a question about Kenneth's comments about the retail jobs creation. We couldn't find any figures for Kansas City, and the only ones we found were for St. Louis, and I think that was actually the study he was citing. Mm-hmm. And it did show that from 1990 to 2007, retail sector employment grew from 142,000 to 147,000 jobs, and so, as I say, what he said was correct.
That was a friendly fact check.
Yeah.
We also had one, a fact, it was about, I guess this is a fact check, but it had to do with the freight quote, which is a business that was given tax incentives here in the Kansas City area, and Bill's shaking his head. I think that's one that moved from Lenexa to the Missouri side at approximately 110th and State Line, and it was 1,000 jobs, but it was just moving them from one side of the state line, and they received $30 million in tax incentives to do that.
And has since been sold, was the note.
Pull great. Up that blighted.
I want to go back and talk about with some of the limited time we have left. I want to ask about community improvement districts, neighborhood improvement districts. On the Kansas side, they're called SMIDs, like self-supporting municipal improvement districts. I'd kind of like to go down the all three of you and say, if a community is willing to tax themselves to generate resources that can then, so businesses are saying, we'll pay a little extra for facade improvement, used for ambassadors sometimes, sidewalks, things along those lines. What are your opinions on those? Is it different than the conversation we've been having? If so, why? Can I start with you at the end, Michael?
Sure. So if there's that much public incentive or public pressure to actually pass a tax for it, then there's obviously a lot of voluntary action that is possible. And these are exactly what chambers of commerce are designed to do. They're voluntary associations of businesses designed to advocate for the concerns of the businesses, just like other advocacy organizations, nonprofits, or advocates for their own special interests. So I think that's actually the better way to go, rather than to say, okay, we're going to go ahead and we're going to tax everyone. We're going to have some willing riders, and we're going to have some people that are just drug along for the ride that are funding this, even though they don't necessarily benefit from it or they don't see a benefit from it.
So would it be fair to characterize your perspective as, if there's anyone who's harmed by it that doesn't want to be harmed by it, then you're creating incentive incongruities in the system?
Yes.
That's fair. Okay. Ken?
Well, in theory, if people wanted to vote for it and tax themselves, that's more legitimate to me than seeing, a local government, which often, like, hides from referenda or something, whatever like that, and just passes some sort of subsidy. But a lot of times, like with transportation development districts, which would be the largest of those sorts of things,
yes,
the people, usually they're drawn so that the only people who can vote on it are the owners of the development, right? The geographic district only includes the owners of the development, and so they decide, well, we're going to raise sales tax 1% or whatever, and yes, we do have to mark it on your receipt at the grocery store, but we've unilaterally raised tax on everybody by 1%. And I don't think that's very fair. To me, they're just, they're TIFs but littler, and they don't have eminent domain attached to them. But I'm not sure that I think they're much better.
Okay.
Great. Yep.
I don't have anything to add.
Okay. Fantastic. Stephen.
Good question here from Beverly Roper, who's first district commissioner in Platte County, Missouri. Beverly, where are you? Thank you. Does the type of TIF matter? Here are some acronyms. Ready? PILOTS, payment in lieu of taxes, versus EATS, economic activity taxes. For example, property tax abatement versus sales tax skim. Does the benefit matter? Is building a facility for a particular party versus infrastructure for all, roads, sidewalks, sewers, and water lines? Can we talk about that a little bit?
Kenneth, start with you.
Okay. Well, I would guess I would say that of all that spending, infrastructure would be the most palatable to me. TIF comes with eminent domain, so that's not so palatable to a lot of people. And you could use other things like transportation development districts, which don't have eminent domain, to build infrastructure. So, I'm not a big fan of most TIFs. I mean, to me, I would like to see TIFs in areas that have meet objective measures of economic deprivation, and that's it. And they wouldn't even have to, if they don't have to compete with, DePere or whatever the richest suburbs around here are, they can offer less to companies or developers to build things than they can if DePere or their equivalent here in Kansas City area are building. So, whether you have PILOTS or EATS, Basically, adding EATS to it like we do in Missouri just means the subsidy, the possibilities become bigger. You know, very few states have multi-hundred million dollar TIFs like we do.
Bill, would the idea of programs that are designed, incentive programs that improve public infrastructure, would that, if Kansas and Missouri were competing on having better and better infrastructure, would that be a negative situation?
Tell me how that would work.
Are any incentive programs, that even ones that would potentially include public infrastructure, are they problematic then too?
So who are you, how are you generating the revenue for the infrastructure?
Through property tax abatements, I would assume. The questions that came up were either property tax abatements or sales tax abatements.
Well, you know, we have a situation on the Kansas side with the Research Triangle where there was a vote for benefiting the University of Kansas Hospital, the Edwards campus, and the K-State campus. Now, in that instance, to me, that was a very appropriate and something that I think is going to have tremendous return on investment over time. Mm-hmm. So that's an instance where I think using the taxing authority is probably going to have a really good outcome in terms of the return.
Okay. Michael, is there any situation you could imagine in the question that was asked where it wouldn't have these kind of negative externality effects?
I'm not saying that it doesn't exist or it's impossible, but my concern is simply very much along the same lines as Kenneth's, that if you're going to do it, it needs to have objective criteria. The biggest problem is the discretion that's allowed in creating this, and that as soon as you allow something like this to have discretion, then it motivates these entrepreneurs, people who would otherwise be using their brain power to figure out how to make a better mousetrap, to say, how can I instead use the tools at my disposal to increase the profits of my company to allow me better to compete and outcompete my competitors. Frederick Bastiat has a quote that kind of really fits this really well. He says, "Government is that fiction by which every person tries to live at the expense of everyone else." And that is the problem that happens when you open it up to discretion.
Great. Stephen.
I'm going to ask you all to look into your crystal balls here for a moment. Would the Sprint Center and Kansas City Downtown Entertainment District have been built without subsidies? And if not, would we have seen the resurgence of the downtown and Crossroads area? Bill, maybe this one's best for you.
Yeah. I don't think so. I think that the landowners in downtown Kansas City would not have been able to lower the price enough, nor would you have been able to acquire the land if you didn't have the incentives and you didn't have eminent domain.
Yeah, you two may not be familiar with the development process behind the Sprint Center. I mean, they're generally paid for through revenue-backed bonds, and the revenue is the 1% is it 1%? It's the tourism tax that was passed at this.
That was on Sprint.
Yeah, on Sprint, yes.
And I guess I suppose it's too soon to predict, but the question has come up about what about the new Hyatt Hotel? Down as, you know, that's yet to be built, but.
Well, we have a strong opinion about the Hyatt Hotel, but
you're not on that side of the business, are you?
I'm not on that side of the business, but I've heard about it. And I think the second owner of the Hyatt Hotel is going to have a really good property.
Look,
the key thing to think about this is not look into your crystal ball and would we have had this amazing urban development without these tools. It's to look into the crystal ball and say, what would have happened without this? Where would have all these funds gone? What are we missing out on that we would have otherwise benefited from? And the answer is, you don't know, because you didn't allow the natural signals to play out the way that occurred. What may be now may be really great, but if it was so great, why couldn't it have happened voluntarily by people organizing. I think part of the problem here is, and this kind of ties in with your background in terms of public administration and how to get people organizing, is that we're starting to rely on the tools of government more than actually talking and organizing with each other individually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I keep coming back to, like, for this conversation, because I think this conversation is important, which is, so this is where we stand today. I mean, what do the first steps toward a better system look like? I think you've given us some with the kind of collaboration or the coming together of business leaders to talk to the governors about, let's quit fighting over this. What else, though? I mean, because that you said 5 years ago that process started. I mean, I don't know where how close we are to it today. So, I mean, what else can be done if this is potentially depressing our economy? And if it's not even doing that, but it's creating these, you know, rent or wealth gains by a very small percentage at the expense of others. So I throw it out maybe to Kenneth to start. Like, what, I mean, would you recommend a European Union style program?
Well, what I would say is, first of all, more people need to know simply what's happening. What, you know, what I call the transparency issue.
Okay.
You know, in some states, you still can't find out what the state or local governments are even doing. So if you don't know the scope of the problem, it's hard to do any sort of organizing around it.
Why don't they know?
Because the businesses don't want them to know.
Okay.
And the economic development officials don't want them to know. If, you know, it, you know, it since like 1995, when Minnesota passed the first really good transparency law for incentives by local governments, and well, it all applied to the state government as well. I mean, we've gone to, you know, maybe 35, 40 states have some sort of transparency law, but they vary in their quality even today, 20 plus years later. So that battle is going in the right direction, but needs to go further. Then the second thing, I mean, I think it goes to, you know, what Bill's doing, which is we need to stop this most egregious kind of subsidy that creates no jobs at all. And these programs just have to be gotten rid of. And it's not going to happen through voluntary agreements, you know, like I mentioned. Either the state legislatures have to pass laws that stop, you know, government officials from doing it, or the federal government's going to have to do something with equivalent effect.
Okay. Michael?
Is it too late to bring back tarring and feathering?
Not necessarily.
Part of it is that the culture needs to change. That if you can bring in a sense of, I don't think shame is necessarily a good thing, but in certain selective circumstances where you're doing things that are harmful to the larger community, then it may be a useful thing to bring out. Transparency is the big one, and I think it's all about baby steps. If we can pick one small thing and get all the states to agree on that one thing, then maybe we can come back a year later and say, what about this other small thing? So my idea is, I mentioned the Tesla Gigafactory example and how they brought in economic development officers from all over the West and said, you know, it's just about like bringing them in blindfolded and saying like, all right, here's this deal, here's this plant, give us an economic development deal in 2 months, and you're not allowed to talk about it. So if you simply have each state commit to legally binding some sort of, within their own law, that they're not allowed to sign any sort of deals that are non-disclosure agreements in economic development. I think that's something that every state would get behind, because Tesla Tesla's not the only company that does this, but they go to each economic development officer and they say, well, so-and-so is offering us this, what can you do to match it? They have no way of verifying that. Yeah. So that, I think, is the very first baby step that you can move to going somewhere, actually.
Right.
You know, we had a very small slice of this. You're talking about a much grander scale. We always thought that the way this would end is when the PTA, someone at the PTA raised their hand when there was an elected official in front of them and said, why isn't my neighbor paying for their child to go to school, and I am? And I've always waited for that question to be asked to, you know, a local representative who can't answer it. Mm-hmm. And if that question was asked enough times in the right forums, it seems to me that this worm would turn on our issue. Mm-hmm. And it's a very small issue compared to the global issues you all are talking about. But that's what needs to happen. We need to have the PTA say 50% of the state budget is going to K-12 education, and you are using these monies that could go to K-12 education, and you're giving them to the guy who owns the business that my neighbor works for.
Yeah. Great.
Well, speaking of transparency, and I'm guessing that this question I have in my hand is on the minds of a lot of people, if two of the elements essential to alter the situation include transparency, regulation, and objectivity, who will dig out the data to share with the voters, and who might be the cause of change? Is it time for an ombudsman of sorts?
Bill?
Well, we had to hire lawyers to get what we were...
Ombudsmen are not lawyers. I'm sorry, lawyers are not ombudsmen.
In order to get the information in the state of Kansas, which was required to be given to us under FOIA, we had to hire lawyers to go down and get it. So the whole issue of transparency is a significant issue. We have been torn in terms of publicizing. There are 108 transactions that have taken place. We know exactly who got what on the PEAK and the Missouri Works program. But publicizing and shaming the companies, what did they do? They didn't do anything. They took advantage of the public policy. So we've been very reluctant to name the names of the individual companies, and we're kind of caught in this quandary of what to do. It is a public policy issue that has to be dealt with by the elected officials. In my view, you shouldn't shame somebody who's doing nothing except following the law.
Yeah. Great. Ken?
Well, I think it's a public policy issue also. And I don't think shame is effective. I mean, you know, there's a strategic situation that governments find themselves in. They need investment. You know, they need funds to run the government. They need to create an economic atmosphere where people are working, right? They need all this. So that's why they wind up getting into bidding wars for businesses in all these different bad ways. But they can't, to me, I don't think it's possible to simply stop. You know, even exchanging information doesn't change a strategic situation, right? I mean, you change this, in the classic prisoner's dilemma, the prisoners can't talk to each other. If you let them talk to each other, they're still stuck. They don't know if they can trust each other. Somebody can say, well, I won't give more than $20 million, and then they go around and say to Cerner or whoever, oh, I'll give you $50 million, and then they wind up with the investment. So they're stuck in a situation, and I think not bidding disadvantages the cities that don't bid. So that's why I think there need to be controls that are enforceable, you know, in law. And at the same time, lots of businesses have realized that every investment decision they make is an opportunity for rent seeking, that they can extract money from governments every time they build a facility.
Michael?
So the question is about the ombudsman. Essentially, it's if we appoint a white knight, will the white knight be able to save us? And the answer is maybe. Maybe we should try it. The question is who will watch the watchers? But it's a worthwhile idea. In terms of the issue of shame and that sort of thing, I agree. It's a very limited use. But the fact that these deals are kind of like behind closed doors. They're made very quickly, and then they kind of come out, and there's a ribbon-cutting ceremony, and it's all focused on the good and not about how the sausage is made. That says something. That says that they don't want you to really know the truth of what's going on behind things. And in terms of, you know, what are the costs of this for a city to bid and not get it, the question there is, well, again, you're the PTA meeting, you know, I'm paying for my child's education and for, you know, the company down the street that my neighbor works at. So there is costs to getting this that distort the local tax base. So in some cases, I would argue that it's actually a better solution for cities not to bid, not to try to participate in this process, to step back from it and say, you know what, the businesses that are going to grow here are the businesses that are going to thrive here. We're not going to throw down a special kind of fertilizer and try to attract new businesses in. Whatever grows here, whatever natural weeds are here, they're going to grow up and they're going to be hardy and they're going to be our own businesses, and they're not going to fly away as soon as somebody else offers them money, which is a key problem when you offer incentives.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, that brings us almost to the end of our time. Can you help me thank our panelists real quick?